featured without explanation on the bulletin board in the aisle and back of the temple next to the temple office. The staff of that office has told me that there has been many an interesting speculation about the nature of this speech. One which particularly tickled my fancy occurred last Tuesday morning after the sisterhood had been here for their weekly sewing. Some of the women passed this bulletin board, and one turned to her companions in puzzlement and bewilderment. How could the rabbi, she wanted to know, how could the rabbi know anything about the way they spent their time at the beauty parlor? Now, I do not intend this morning to invade the privacy of her movie magazine sanctuary. I do not intend either to concern myself with the inevitable but nevertheless wasted waiting hours of our week. The hours that we spend driving to work, waiting for our children at school, shaving in the morning, waiting for the evening meal to be cooked and ready for the dinner table. There are good uses to which these moments might be put. That is another sermon for another day. This morning, my title was in a sense chosen for me. It is taken from an article which appeared in last week's Life magazine, which was an examination or a series of impressions of the Protestant Sunday school system in today's America. The author, Mr. Wesley Schrader, felt that the Protestant Sunday schools were unruly, not overly modern in technique or approach, and lacking in professional staff, in capable teachers, in purpose and in direction. He felt that many young people who were exposed to these Sunday schools left them hardly impressed with either the beauty or the meaning of Christianity. He felt that even worse than this, many of the young people who went to these religious schools came away with an active dislike of their faith, with a hatred of it, which turned itself into indifference and antipathy to Christianity and unwillingness to join the church once they had become adults. Now, I cannot defend the Protestant Sunday schools. This is not my province, and I'm not competent to do so. But I am confident that there will be many able and active champions of their cause who will see to it that this article is refuted. Because as you read his impressions, you realize that they are just that, highly subjective personal impressions, without statistical basis, without factual basis. A series of emotional reactions, as it were, to several unpleasant episodes and occurrences which he has sensed as a minister of the Protestant faith who has fled the active ministry into the quiet and peace of the walls of Yale University. It seems to me the height of bad taste for a man in today's America, for a man in our society which permits both young and old such large amounts of wasted time, to claim that any amount of religious education, however badly conceived and presented, is the most wasted hour of the week. Think of the wasted hours of our young people, the hours of endless telephone conversation, the hours of aimless joyriding, the hours of limitless television viewing, the hours of just being out with the gang doing whatever they are doing. Think of the problem which this excessive leisure time has created for the American people and for the American youth. And even though we would qualify this by saying that this does not necessarily mean that this leisure time is mischievous in its effect, deleterious in effect, even though this leisure time does not necessarily lead these people into the wrong paths and the wrong ways, because it seems that a large amount of apparently aimless preoccupation with oneself is part of the strange alchemy of growing up, nevertheless, The constructive use of leisure time has become one of the cardinal problems of our society. And I believe that it takes a very uncritical author not to realize that the single hour allocated in a week for religious training can hardly qualify for the title of being the most wasted hour of the week. It is one thing to say that this hour is not used to its fullest. It is quite another to claim that it is totally useless. In fact, unfortunate. But I would turn your attention this morning from the Protestant religious schools to our own. Very often, similar attacks are leveled against the Jewish weekend school. We are told that our curriculum is outmoded, techniques of our education are outdated, that our teachers are not sufficiently trained in modern educational philosophy and technique, that our discipline is unruly, that for the amount of labor and finance and preoccupation which we spend in our schools, we hardly produce a product worthy of the name of an educated scholar in Judaism. Many a rabbi could multiply the example with which Mr. Schrader began his article. He said that he was moved to write this piece because a young man, a 14-year-old, a paragon of youthful virtue by the name of Tom, came home from the religious school and said to his parents, "I have had enough. I refuse to go back. This religious school hour is the most wasted hour in the week." Rabbis, as well as ministers, hear this comment day after day. Our religious school here in the temple is uniquely well-staffed, uniquely well-conceived, uniquely well-disciplined. And yet, after confirmation, 5 out of 10 of every young graduate refuses to re-enroll himself in our high school. And if you would take a national level, you would find that our percentage of returnees to the Temple High School is paramount, that no school in the country can claim even 5 of 10 returning. Now, shall we say that this is cause for grave concern, that we must examine the ways and the policies and the purposes and the principles of our religious school and see wherein it has failed? Certainly it is true that no religious school, no school is universally successful. Teaching is, after all, a uniquely complex undertaking. It involves itself in multitudinous human interrelationships. There is the personality of the teacher, and the personality of the child, and the personality of the home. And very often, one or another of these qualities interposes and prevents an adequate education or an adequate relationship from being developed. And no school, however well conceived, however well planned, however well carried out, can claim universal success in the training and the education of the young scholars committed to its care. But having said this, must we look to the religious school for the source of our difficulties, for the reasons for indifference as to its programs, for the reason that many of our adolescents are unwilling to continue in their religious education? I think that the fault lies elsewhere. I would have you remember the role which Sunday school occupies in our culture. It's a fine place to send your children. There they'll learn simple truths, simple stories, and a simple faith. Do good, love God, to be charitable. But for the adult, for the mature person, the Sunday school is a matter more of joke-making than of reverence. It is not for him. It does not get faith sufficient or a profundity of knowledge sufficient to impress him. He does not read in Jewish law. He is not concerned with the intricacies of Jewish literature or the bypass of Jewish history. Why should his son or his daughter be concerned? Sunday school for the child, but training for the adult, our society tends to frown upon, to laugh upon, to question. I had occasion just this last week to have in my office one of the young scholars of our confirmation class. A good boy, a fairly bright young lad. But he had been acting up of late, and especially in his literature class, he'd been a matter of grave concern to the teacher. He was not doing his work, he was not paying attention, he was being totally unruly. She asked me to speak to him, and I did. We began by talking about the importance of the study which he was undertaking. His literature class dealt with our prayer book, and I asked him if he didn't feel that it was important to know the history and the meaning and the purpose of the book, which perhaps more than any other book will be part of his life. He will pick up that prayer book and use it in services more often than he will pick up any other book in the course of his days. He shook his head. He looked at me quizzically with doubting eyes, and he said, "Rabbi," he said, "my parents don't use that book. They come on the high holidays, but they don't know its history. They don't know its meaning. They are indifferent to the purpose of the individual prayers. Why should I care? They haven't needed to. Why should I care?" A young people raised in this atmosphere, why should I care? Why should I care about the deeper meanings, about the profound insights of our faith, if my parents do not care, if my society does not care? Young people raised in that tradition will inevitably find reasons to excuse and to rationalize their desires to leave the religious school classrooms and to have free time on the weekends. We cannot wonder at it. I wonder if we should not look at the society of which we are part, rather than at the structure of the religious school. We want to find the true answer to the question which Mr. Schrader raised in his article, why there seems to be a certain indifference, indeed active antipathy, on the part of the adolescent and the university youth of our day to religious school training of any type. If we would understand the religious school, its purpose, its reason for being, its technique, I submit that we should turn our attention not to the antipathy or the questioning of the young people who surround us, but to its history and to the role which it has always played in our Jewish religious life, to the role which it is now seeking to play in that life. And when we examine the institution of religious education, and when we have examined the role which education has played in our people's history, we come to realize that it is a profound, nay, a fundamental one. When the Jews stood at Sinai, when the Jews first received the law from God, when they first really became a people dedicated to our faith, they received many laws, moral, ritual, civil, criminal. They received a whole way of life which they were encouraged to take to themselves and to make real in the fabric of their daily lives. And they were told that the way to do this was to see to it that it was taught diligently by each father to each son, by each generation to the next, by each scholar to his disciples. This was the way of Jewish learning. This was the way of Jewish survival. Shinantem levonecha, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Now this could be a matter of verbal pious rhetoric, nothing more. It could be a matter of words spoken by hopeful leaders and not put into practice in the lives of the people, but it was not so by our people. Education has been the cardinal concern of Jewry and Judaism throughout 3,000 years of history. Jewish life revolves around three pillars. One is the pillar of philanthropy and of good works. One is the pillar of worship and of prayer. And the third is the pillar of learning and of education. And of these three fundaments, it is uniquely in Jewish tradition the fundamental concept of education and learning which is paramount. In Jewish life, if all the agencies, the social service agencies of a community are in need of funds, the school has the right to require that its needs be met first. If it is a question of a congregation being unable to build both a synagogue and a school, the school must be built before the synagogue is built. A synagogue may be changed into a school, but a school may not be changed into a synagogue. Parents are not allowed to spend monies that on other things in their community if they have not the funds with which to educate their children. And Jewish life, following these maxims of the rabbis, Jewish life was able to develop first in history, first in civilization, a concept of universal public education. The American school system is based, finally, on roots which were laid 2,100 years ago in ancient Judea, when the rabbis conceived and put into practice a system of compulsory public education. Jewish life was the first to develop a concept of adult education. 1,500 years before the University of Chicago conceived the Great Books course and awakened American life to the importance of adult education, the universities of Sura and of Nisibis in Babylonia had semi-annual kalamans, semi-annual convocations where the average intelligent adult was invited to come to these university centers and there study some ancient texts and there engage in dialogue and dialectic with qualified teachers and become more aware of the meaning and the purpose and the philosophy of the world in which he lived. Judaism ultimately has been saved by this emphasis on learning. Of these three pillars of which we have spoken, of philanthropy and good works, of worship and of prayer, and finally of learning, it is the emphasis on learning alone which has saved Jewry. Throughout our history, we seldom built brick and stone fortresses for our defense. And when we built them, they were not universally successful in defending us. What defended us was the book. What defended us was the word spoken in the classroom. Philanthropy can only bind the wound that has freshly been cut. The communities which depended entirely upon faith, upon some supernatural intervention by God, ultimately were annihilated and perished. Only those communities which invested their funds in teachers and in academies and emphasized learning and training, only they were successful in meeting the challenges of living and of preparing the youth for whatever challenges they had to respond to in life, for whatever difficulties and obstacles they would have to face, for whatever goals they could conquer within the political life which surrounded them. Only the power of ideas transmitted from generation to generation, from father to son, from scholar to disciple, saved our people and brought them to this day. There's a true story of one of the rabbis which is both historically true and in this context symbolically true. It is the history of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived in the first century of this era. He lived during a period in which ancient Judea, a small state, felt that its grievances against mighty Rome, Rome, mistress of the world, were so great that she had to rebel, to voice her antipathy and her anger by rebellion. In the year 67 of this common era, ancient Judea did rebel. And for 3 years, her bravery, her courage, her loyalty to basic ideals enabled her to stand against the might of Rome. But inevitably, Rome's juggernaut wore her down, and finally, in the year 70, Jerusalem was besieged. The holy city was about to be taken. It looked as if Judaism, as we know it, was about to perish from off the face of this globe. The holy city was to be razed, the holy temple was to be razed, the people's morale was broken and shattered. There seemed no reason to believe that Judaism, like the phoenix, could rise again from the ashes of a burnt-out city and a burnt-out faith. And at this moment, this Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who has lived in Jerusalem, found a way of saving his people. No living man was allowed outside the gates. The only thing that was allowed to the Jews was that their dead might be passed over in their coffins, over the walls of the city, and be buried outside the city in some burial ground, so that the city might not be filled with pestilence and disease. And this rabbi had himself immured in a coffin and passed over the wall of the city and taken to the burial ground, to the graveyard of the Jews. And there he broke out of his coffin and appeared before the emperor Vespasian and asked of this emperor permission to open an academy, a school at Yavne, a small community in central Judea. At this school, the fact that Judaism continued to be taught and sought after, understood, and committed to a new generation, this school saved Judaism. All our later Jewish communities spring from the well of knowledge and the well of lifeblood which was taught here at Yavne. Even when we were being carried to the grave, when our coffin had almost been nailed shut, when the last eulogy had been spoken over our people, our love of learning, our willingness to rebuild our academies, to refill our schools, to see to it that the young somehow were trained, that courage, that consistency and constancy of purpose and of dedication to learning saved the Jew and brought us till this day. And along the way, what a wonderful, mighty concept of education the Jew developed. Education was to be universal, not limited to a small priestly class or a small nobility class, but open to all people. The fullest use was to be made of the mental abilities of every Jew. There was a curriculum which was integrated and developed. We had our kindergartens and our lower schools and our higher schools and our universities and our graduate schools. We had a system of tuitions and of tutorings and of scholarships. We had a concept of motivation. There are discussions in the Talmud about grading systems which would parallel almost word by word many of the discussions which we still hear today. Almost all that is best and positive in modern educational method was pioneered in a sense. The standards were set forth in our Jewish tradition. They knew, fully knew, long before the days of progressive education, that a child must feel positively attracted to the school. The first day of school attendance was made a wonderful holiday for the child. The five-year-old was taken on the shoulders of his father and paraded in new clothes through the streets of the city. And he was taken into the synagogue and blessed there by the rabbi. And then he was taken to the home of his future master. And his first lesson was not written on a blackboard. It was not written on a mimeographed sheet of paper and a text. It was written on a honey cake. And after he had learned his first letters, the child was allowed to eat this cake. And it was hoped thereby that lessons would always be sweet for him. It was hoped thereby that his appetite for knowledge had been whetted. Read Jewish traditional writings, and you will be impressed by their awareness of all of the problems, all of the opportunities, all of the pitfalls, and all the potentialities of learning. But we cannot be a people who live only in the past. Today's reality is obviously not yesterday's. Today, obviously, we have a totally new situation with us. Are we still the people who made cardinal and basic a dependency upon learning and teaching? I wonder. Within the last 100 years, the world of Jewish education has been shaken to its very foundations. The political emancipation of the Jew after the French Revolution in the various countries of Europe and of this world, this new world, the political emancipation of the Jew brought great advantage to our people. Educationally, the doors of the universities were one by one swung open. And for the first time, the Jews were able to drink of the professional and higher knowledge which our Western civilization had accumulated. For the first time, the Jew was in one country after another allowed to enroll in the public school system and to take advantage of all that the resources of a community, rather than to have to depend simply on his own parochial resources. New worlds of science, of culture, and of literature were open to the Jew. For in the last several hundred years of immediately preceding Jewish history, our people had in a sense been in one of their byways and had been out of the mainstream of the development of Western civilization. We gained much by this political and educational emancipation, but we also lost a great deal. Where Jewish training had been a matter of 40 to 60 hours a week in the parochial school of the Jewish community, it now became a matter of half an hour on the weekend. Where Jewish education had been a constant immersion of the child in a world of Jewish culture and learning from his earliest years into his maturity, it now became a matter of several hours a week or a month or a year, where he barely scratched the surface of what Jewish tradition had to teach. Where Jewish education was once firmly rooted in the accumulated inspiration of the past, now found that these roots had atrophied, and the child could drink only the most surface and superficial waters which Judaism could offer to him. And secondly, where Jewish education had once been mandatory in the same sense that it is mandatory upon our children in the state of Ohio to attend the public schools until the age of 16. Where Jewish education had once been mandatory, it now became voluntary. And many an interested child was made to suffer because of the indifference of his parents, because his parents weren't willing to pay his tuition fee or to enroll themselves in some congregation. We have even today in our religious school one young lad who came to us during this year and begged to be allowed to attend our classes, even though his parents refused to pay his tuition, to enroll themselves in our temple, or have anything to do with the Jewish community. Many a child suffered from the indifference or the revolt or the rebellion of their parents. And only a generation ago, two out of every three Jewish young people failed to receive in their lifetime a single hour of religious education. And thirdly, Jewish education in our day and age has become primarily a child-centered education. How many children in conservative and orthodox congregations continue their training after they have been bar mitzvahed? How many young people in our own Reformed temples continue their training after confirmation? We have concentrated on the child. We have done wonders with the child. But after the early teens, we never almost see the young person. And we are faced with almost a hopeless dilemma. How to teach a mature faith to immature minds? How to make real the thought of Judaism to minds which have hardly begun to think? Now, the first of these problems, the problem of the curtailment of time, is one which we can in our meeting. But none of us would turn back the hands of time. If we must teach more in less time, and we must prune intelligently, we must present intelligently, and we must use intelligently the best modern techniques. If our schools are to be voluntary associations instead of mandatory associations, then we must see to it that temple programs and synagogue activities are made intriguing and interesting and important to the families of our community. And in both of these first two realms, we have made great progress. Our textbooks, our curriculum, our teaching methods are modern and up-to-date in most religious schools throughout our land. We have been able to capsule much of Jewish life and to present it to the child in assimilable form. We have made great progress in enrolling the families of our Jewish communities in our synagogues and our temples so that our young people may receive some religious education. But this third difficulty is the roadblock, is the obstacle which we cannot surmount and overleap, because there is no way on earth for us to teach the profound insights of Judaism into minds which are hardly aware of the problems of life, or the perplexities of living, of the questions which every intelligent adult raises. The most damaging facts in Jewish life today are these. That only one out of every 75 young people is receiving a single hour of religious training after he has been either bar mitzvahed or confirmed. That only one out of every 250 of our university youth is attending a single hour class, either in his university or at Hillel, in the meaning and the relevance and the importance of Judaism. That only one out of every 750 of our young people who are above the university age and below 30, only one out of every 750 of these attends during that 10-year decade a single hour of adult education in the synagogues or temples or community centers of our land. We are asking Judaism, a mature faith, an adult faith, to limp along through life in the minds of its believers, of its parishioners, of its congregants, with immature ideas. We are saying to it, your hands are tied as far as teaching your real reasonings, your real philosophy. You must teach superficially. You must teach only the surface, only the ritual, only the rites, only the most superficial ideas which you have to offer. This is the greatest challenge which Judaism faces. We must find a way to drive Judaism home to the adult. When the adult world finds reason for believing, reason for reading, reason for taking part in adult education forums, the young people who ape the adult world, who set their standards by what they see around them, they too will find their way back. Our temple has fortunately always been one of the pioneers in this field. Our Temple High School, now some 30 years old, is one of the standard-setting adolescence high schools of our land. Only some 20 of the 500 Reformed congregations in America have, in that 30-year period, been able to take our example and put it into practice. But this is but the drop in the bucket, the single pebble of sand on the beach. We have to find a way to develop the techniques and the approach which will interest the adult Jew and the Jew who is a young adult in the meaning, the importance, and the relevance of his faith. I would like to be able to invite each and every one of you to come through our school and to see it in operation. I think that you will be tremendously impressed by what you find. You will find textbooks which are modern, well illustrated, written to the exact reading level of the class, filled with the best of modern textbook techniques, relevant to the life of the child who is reading them. You will find teachers trained, certified, who know all that is best and most important to know about classroom management and technique, teaching method. You will find a cadet teachers program whereby we are attempting to prepare many of our own young people to step into these classrooms to not only know the theory of education, but the theory of Judaism, that they may be wholly prepared to answer the questions which the young people raise. You will find a disciplined school. You will find a school whose standards are high, remarkably high, and have been purposely kept so. But you will also see certain limitations in our school. Limitations, I think, and this is the burden of all that I've said this morning, which are not the fault of the school, but the fault or the lack or the want in our society. You will see, first of all, that we suffer from the unwillingness or the disinterest of our young people in matters purely intellectual and purely cultural. The world of the Talmud, like the world of the classics of Virgil and of Plato and of Homer, does not interest, does not intrigue the adult world. and cannot expect it to intrigue the child. Few people today are willing to spend the time to discover the idiomatic secrets, the keys which will unlock the great literary treasures of this world. We want everything presented to us in amended texts, bridged and concise books. And so you will not find in our school, as you will not find in the public school systems, or perhaps even in some of our universities, a great love of learning for the sake of learning, a great desire to read the classics of Judaism simply because they are the classics and they have great beauty, aesthetic and philosophic. And secondly, you will see that we suffer from discontinuity. We teach once a week, and especially in our teaching of Hebrew, the lesson which is learned one Saturday is quickly forgotten in the 6 days and must be relearned the next. We must in Jewish life find some way of reestablishing the continuity of learning, that some block of review at least, of homework is done each week. Perhaps the answer here lies in the development of summer school programs, much like the Christian summer Bible schools. But you will sense that this discontinuity of classroom work is one of the great lacks of our religious school. You will sense, third of all, I think that we suffer in our religious school from being second-class educational citizens. When a child takes a homework assignment home, he is told by the parent that this is to be done after his public school work is completed and not before. If there are two themes to be done, the public school theme is done first, and ours only if time is available. If the child has fallen behind in the religious school and fallen behind in the public school, then he is urged by his parent to make up the religious school, the public school, and if he falls behind in the religious school, so much the worse. He and they will survive. Now, this discounting of what is being taught in the religious school affects the whole attitude of the child for our school. And even though he may do his assignments after all the other assignments have been completed, he will do them with a sense of their unimportance, at least of their unimportance to his parents. And ultimately, this will be one of the compounding elements in the growing disinterest and dissatisfaction of the child with our school. You will sense also in our religious school, I think, a certain problem of manners. I purposely did not use the word discipline. Our children are unmannerly. Unmannered somewhat in dress, unmannered somewhat in speech, unmannered somewhat in behavior. And this too, I think, is a reflex of the society in which they find themselves. They push ahead of the teacher into the classroom. They scuffle in the halls to get first into line. They come to the religious school dressed as hoydens, dressed as in other generations no one would have been allowed out of the house. And this, too, is a problem which we must face. For the sloppiness of dress and of attitude and of manners communicates itself into sloppy patterns of learning. And these young people are somewhat superficial and mixed up in the facts which they accept, which become part of them. Precision, discipline, learning and thought is not one of their fortes. And finally, you will sense the problem of child-centeredness. You will see that our lower school is a magnificent school, filled with the best of all that modern educational theory can offer. But you will see to it that there is a progressive deterioration of interest as a child passes the confirmation age. This, too, is a reflex of the society. Here, too, we must find a way to make our congregations realize that confirmation is not an end. In fact, it's hardly a beginning. We must make them realize that confirmation isn't a final goal towards which they and the children must work. And perhaps this can be done only at the cost of destroying the whole confirmation ceremony, or of making it occur at the last year of high school. Because some way, somehow, we must find the key to making our people aware that by 13, By 14, in this day and age, a child has hardly begun to think. And that the education which we have been able to give the child is perhaps some knowledge of the holidays and of the prayers of our people, a sense of at-homeness in the faith. But we have not given him a mature faith. We have not given him a faith which can withstand the challenges of sophomoric university cynicism. We have not given him a faith which will carry him through the traumatic and difficult days of his life. We have given him only the beginnings of a faith. We have exposed him only to the surface of what Judaism is, the sea and the depths. And this is our greatest problem. But you will sense also in our religious school that we have passed the age of turmoil and of chaos. That there is meaning and purpose in all that is being done. That great strides are being taken, even in this last field, to make the relevance and the beauty of Judaism part and parcel of the life blood of the young adult. You will see, for instance, that our high school program is a well-conceived and well-developed one, in which not only is formal education presented, but the child is given full opportunity to question, to query, to express his doubts, and to have them discussed openly in class. You will see as you look at Judaism and as you look at our temple that we are beginning to make use of larger blocks of time, whole weekends away, whole days where they are free from the school, where we can give a more continuous view of some subject or some discipline that needs to be mastered. You will see in the increased awareness of our parents' groups and of our adults in this congregation, in all congregations, in matters which revolve around adult education, seminars, great books courses, that they too are groping now for something more in their faith in the observance of the holidays and of the ritual. They too want to be introduced into the insights, the depths, the profundities of Judaism. And as they seek, so shall their children find. Much has been done. Much remains to be done. On its being completed, rest the future of American Jewry.